I feel a little bit like what I'm going to be trying to do this afternoon is writing a letter of recommendation. I'm sure many of you have had the chance to write a letter of recommendation to an employer about somebody that's trying to get a job there. And that's kind of what I'd like to do today, is just interest you briefly in Domhelder Câmara, Archbishop of Recife, Olinda, Brazil. He is one of a series of people that will be presented at various times during the summer as living epistles of hope or as apostles of hope. A lot of them are, as Charlie pointed out at lunch, are up on the posters around the dining hall. One bit of introduction that I will give is a brief quote from one of the books I read about him. The introduction to the book was written by Richard Shaw. He says, "Domhelder is a man of peace, forced to live in a world of conflict and violence, take sides in it and fight. For him, the way of peace is not a mere political tactic, it is a way of life. For him, the only really human society is one in which men have learned to share the abundance of God's gifts. Anything that violates this order, even the ants eating the rose bush in his garden, perturbs him deeply." I'll begin just by giving a factual biography, a relatively short one, sort of to set the scene, to give you some idea of who the person is and the situation in which he is working right now. He is a native of Brazil, and Brazil right now, I guess, has the largest nominally Catholic population in the world, where 90% of a population of 110 million claim nominal allegiance to the Roman Catholic Church. Only about 10 or 15% of those, though, are practicing Catholics. The reason is that so many people there have become disenchanted with the Catholic Church and the traditional links between the church and the established order that seems to favor the rich at the expense of the poor. So there's a very poor percentage that are practicing Catholics. Brazil, one of the sources I read, split Brazil into three worlds. The one that they called the plastic miracle of the technocrats and generals. Plastic in that it's glossy on the outside, it looks like all sorts of wonderful things are happening, but underneath, in fact, what is going on is what Domhelder calls internal colonization, which is, yes, there is a lot of progress being made, but the progress is mainly benefiting, again, the rich at the expense of the poor. The underworld of Brazil, the second world of the impoverished, is really sad. I could give you many facts and figures to paint a picture, but I'll just throw a few out. The average person in the part of Brazil that Domhelder works in, the Northeast, receives about 52% of the recommended number of calories in their diet. That's the average person, and this is according to government census, Brazil government census figures. The mothers there are so malnourished that the average IQ of newborn infants is about 75. So this gives some idea of the setting in which Domhelder is working. The third world of Brazil is that world that Domhelder is trying to bring about, and that's the emerging world of the downtrodden people who are beginning to find dignity and are beginning to get more of a fair share of the resources and jobs of the country. Domhelder was born in 1909. He was one of 12 children. Six of them died in childhood. Five of them died in 1 month of croup. Of the 12 children, only One of his brothers and one of his sisters survived to this day. His mother was a school teacher. She was devoutly Catholic. She wanted to name him Jose. And to this day, when he writes, he uses the pen name of Don Jose. Helder's father was a Freemason who had very little time for religious practices, and it was his will that finally won out in naming Helder. He just opened up a Dutch dictionary and came across the name Helder, which is a Dutch word meaning fortress, and that's how his son was named. Helder followed a fairly typical educational path, went to pre-seminary school and went on to seminary. When he was at when he was at the seminary, one fault for which he is remembered is that he had an independent and questioning mind. One interesting incident: when he was at seminary, apparently all the students had their own little lockers to keep their books and notes and so forth. And every once in a while, the head father at the seminary would go into, he also had a key to all the students' lockers, and he would go in and make sure there was no subversive literature or anything like this. He went into Dom Helder's locker and took out some poetry. Well, Dom Helder discovered that the father had been in his locker, but Dom Helder, being the way he is, did not want to embarrass the father by going up to him and saying, "Have you been in my locker? Did you take something?" So he just sat on it for a while until finally the head father could wait no longer and called Dom Helder in and talked to him. And he said, and I quote this, "My son, I found some poems in your locker, and that is terrible. If you give rein to your imagination, your priesthood may be compromised." After Dom Helder graduated from the seminary, for a while he became part of a fascist movement, being convinced at the time that communism was probably one of the greatest threats to the gospel throughout the world, and that the maintenance of law and order was the only safe way to protect the church. During this time, he worked very closely in the government, with the government. At one time, he was considered as one of the candidates to run for the mayor of Rio. Slowly, though, he began, as he had recalled, an independent questioning mind. He began doing a lot of reading and began to see, especially through the readings of, well, some of the papal encyclicals of John the 23rd, and also the readings of, and somebody can correct me on the pronunciation, Jacques Maritain. He slowly began to have his social consciousness raised, and he began to see that, in fact, it was neither the right nor the left that was the main evil in the world, but that it was the structures that kept the distance between the rich and the poor. And from this point on, he began working with the masses. He's always been very good at organizing. Started the Movement for Basic Education, Operation Hope. He's had all kinds of movements going like that, working with the people. During this time, though, he began to lose popularity with government officials. He, recall earlier, had been in favor. One of the reasons was that he preached a spiritual gospel to the poor and kind of kept the masses quiet, and all of a sudden he was riling them up and tended to lose favor. In 1964, there was a coup in Brazil and generals came to power. Not long after this, although he maintains that there's no connection between the two events, not long after this, he was reassigned from Rio to Recife Olinda, which is in the poorest part of Brazil and which is the locus of his activities today. I'll be getting into those a little bit more as I talk about some of his thought later on. The last little bit of strict biographical information I'll share is just the fact that he is very well known internationally, but locally is not heard very well at all. He has received the Martin Luther King International Peace Prize. I forget the year, but he received, it's been called either the Alternate Peace Prize or the People's Peace Prize, the same year that the Nobel Peace Prize was given to Henry Kissinger and Lê Duc Tho. There were a lot of people in the world that were kind of upset with that choice, so they raised funds and came up with this Alternate Peace Prize. He was the recipient of that, and the money he received for that was used to start an agricultural commune up in the northeast of Brazil. Right now, he is allowed no use of the media in Brazil. He has no local recognition. The only exception to that is he is given 5 minutes every morning on the local radio station in Olinda. That's the limit of his use of the media. He says, "Today I am becoming one of the voiceless poor of Brazil. Only on local radio can my voice be heard. The national press and radio are forbidden to report anything I say. When I am attacked in the most widely read newspapers, I am not allowed the use of the media to reply." Luckily, he is not silent to us. There are many ways in which we hear him and read him. And I will be sharing some of those with you out of two books, both of which are for sale in the bookstore. One is The Desert is Fertile, which includes some of his meditations as well as just some regular prose. A Thousand Reasons for Living is mainly a series of short meditations. To give a little background to meditations and what they are to him, I have to tell you a little about his daily routine. I should say nightly routine. He's in the habit of going to bed about 10:30 at night and gets up at 2 in the morning, stays up until 4 in the morning, then at 4 he goes back to bed for another hour, gets up again at 5 because he has to say Mass again at 6. So he's a rather busy man. That 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock time is a very special time for him, though. He begins by saying his short prayers, and then he looks up at the sky and begins to recount the events of the day before. He always looks at the specifics from the day before and tries to find universal truths in them, or ways that he can tie those together. He uses that time also to write meditations, little short thoughts, poems, and it's those that are featured in here, and some are in The Desert is Fertile. As I'm reading some of his meditations and some of his other works, and you may have noticed already, he tends to use almost exclusively male pronouns, male imagery. He never specifically, in anything that I've run into, has never addressed the idea of inclusive language, but somehow it does not bother me at all to hear him use predominantly male imagery, because I'm sure that he is a very inclusive person. Also in his language, or in his intent for the language, I should say, he at one point is talking to atheists and invites atheists to listen to what he is saying and to translate the words that he's using into the words that they hear the best. So I'm sure that he would wish the same thing for those of us that would like to hear more inclusive language. I'll begin by, what I've done is taken a number of meditations from both books, and I've clustered them together in several themes that seem to run throughout his thought. The first theme that I sort of picked up on was that of unity or organization. And I'll read a couple meditations here. "In a fabulous necklace, I had to admire the anonymous string by which the whole thing was strung together." "Everything is touched with mystery, since everything comes from your hands, or from those of the co-creator, the paper on which I write, the pen I use, the table where I sit, the books surrounding me, the clothes I wear, the air I breathe, the light I gaze at, the soil that bears me. My heart thrills with joy, a radiant sense of universal unity. The whole idea of unity, of organizing people, things, movements into one, has always been one of his strong points. He, not long after his conversion to a more socially oriented stance, he organized a conference of bishops throughout Brazil, which later was expanded to include the bishops throughout Latin America. He has tried consistently to work through institutions. He has always been very loyal to institutions, but slowly has come to the realization that institutions probably are not going to be the way that a more just world is brought about. He says, I was forced to accept that institutions as a whole are too cumbersome to be manipulated. It isn't easy to mobilize even a single university. It's impossible to mobilize several. And it's the same with churches and trade unions. So then I discovered minorities. It's true that all the various institutions taken as a whole are difficult to move. But it's also absolutely true, experimentally demonstrable, that in every institution, every human group everywhere, no matter what the country, race, or religion, there are minorities who, beneath a vast diversity of denominations, leaders, and objectives, share a common hunger and thirst for justice, minorities for whom justice is the path of peace. I call them Abrahamic minorities, in honor of Abraham, the father of all those who over the centuries have continued to hope against hope. But I should like to find a more universal name for them. Jews and Muslims and Christians know Abraham, but Abraham means nothing in the East. I now believe that the moral pressure to liberate mankind will come not from institutions as a whole, but from the minorities that I still call Abrahamic. And it's organizing, making contact with, unifying these minorities that he has wanted to work with so consistently. Closely allied to this idea of unity and organization is a tremendous sense of Domhelder being completely open to everyone and everything. He's always available. I'll read several meditations that I think illustrate this. Become an expert in the art of discovering the good in every person. No one is entirely bad. Become an expert in the art of finding the truthful core in views of every kind. The human mind abhors total error. This one's called Always Stop, Always Welcome. Speeding by go the buses without stopping, signaling what I must never signal, full. When you are present to see the scaffolding removed, admire. That's plain, the building that emerges. But ask after the scaffolding, for it's no joke to have served as support during construction, to have been essential to the work, and then, on topping out day, to be removed like rubbish. He has this tremendous ability to always look at things from the other side. I mean, how many people would think about the scaffolding that is used to put up a building? It seems to me that his mother probably had a very great influence on him in this ability to see things from the other side, to look at things from different angles. Two stories that illustrate this influence of his mother. There was, in the town where he was growing up, there was a young man who was murdered, and the town folk were all running around feeling a lot of pity for the mother of the victim. And Domhelder's mother, without negating the need for that pity, said, yes, but we should also remember to feel some pity for the mother of the murderer. His mother also told him at one time, gave him a good insight into the reason that peoples do not get along. And she said that if you look at people very closely, well, let me read this. When a person seems to us to be bad, if one gets near to him, if one makes the effort to know him from within, one discovers that the root cause is weakness. That is why Christ on Calvary said of those who had done more than the rest, who had left him naked, who had struck and wounded him, even of these, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Domhelder remains tremendously open to this day. He's never been known to turn down a journalist or a photographer, even if that person seems to be annoying him. Two of the books that I read were by a person that had spent a lot of time and had seen this happening. And apparently Domhelder at times will kind of look up and kind of take a big sigh and then will go and be available to the photographer. The reason that he gives is he never wants to lose out the possibility of doing some good. He is not trying to outguess Providence, as it were. I think that idea is shown in this meditation. Accept surprises that upset your plans, shatter your dreams, give a completely different turn to your day, and who knows, to your life. It is not chance. Leave the Father free himself to weave the pattern of your days. Domhelder has always had a very firm commitment to nonviolence. This follows through a lot of his writings and thoughts. Some people are like sugarcane. Even when crushed in the mill, completely squashed, reduced to pulp, all they can yield is sweetness. That image of being crushed and yet yielding nothing but sweetness is something that he definitely has had plenty of opportunity to do. One of his organizations, Operation Hope, at one point had 8 of its members imprisoned and tortured. Another close friend of his was beaten, then shot, and then hung. And this becomes a special burden to him because he knows that these people are suffering because of their association with him. Yet he himself is too well known to become a target. The police won't ever come after him. Instead, they will pick on his associates. He has, on several occasions, when an associate has been imprisoned, packed up his bags and gone down to the police station and has turned himself in and said, listen, the person you really want is me. I'm the one that's causing the problem. And he has consistently been turned away. So he not only preaches nonviolence, but with those sorts of actions is definitely putting it into practice. He is not especially fond of the term nonviolence, though. And I think it's also significant to remember that Latin America is not exactly a hotbed of nonviolence. I don't know too many places that are, but Latin America especially is, nonviolence is considered an ineffective tool of those that are too weak to do anything else, which is why he does not like the phrase nonviolence. He says, I don't like that expression. I much prefer the phrase the violence of the pacifist or any other definition that emphasizes the contrast with passivism. How can we expect young people to renounce armed violence unless we offer them something strong and effective in exchange? something that can achieve concrete results. While he has consistently been nonviolent in his actions and in his words, he also has respect and understanding for those who choose violent means to achieve just ends. He doesn't always agree, but he respects those. He says, I respect those who feel obliged in conscience to opt for violence, not the all-too-easy violence of the armchair revolutionary, but that of those who proved their sincerity by the sacrifice of their lives. In my opinion, the memory of Camilo Torres and Che Guevara merits as much respect as that of Martin Luther King. He does believe that finally nonviolent means will be the only way that the paradox of the oppressed people becoming the oppressors can be broken. It will be interesting sometime to talk with Karen Schrammore about her experiences in Nicaragua, because apparently it seems that paradox there has not been borne out. That violent overthrow has seemed not to result in the oppressed becoming oppressors. Another area that has been a focus of his thoughts, and fairly obviously from the area in which he lives, is that of poverty. He says, "You want to be, excuse me, first get free of that excess of goods which cram your whole body, leaving no room for you, and even less for God." Not even you, capital U, with your irresistible look of infinite goodness, succeeded in moving the heart of the rich young man. And yet he, from his childhood, had kept all the commandments. Lord, my Lord, may we never, out of mistaken charity, water down the terrible truths you have spoken to the rich. His sensitivity to poverty was shown probably most dramatically not long after he was transferred to Recife Olinda. When he first moved there, he was brought to the Episcopal Palace. And in fact, he lived there for 4 years. This is a big, ornate bishop's palace. He recalls during those 4 years sitting, eating his dinner with poor people waiting. He calls them like patient oxen watching him eat. And he completely lost his appetite. He found it real hard to eat with this all around him. So he decided, this is ridiculous. The Episcopal Palace is not a place that the people of this parish, of this congregation, can feel at home in. So he moved out and rents a small, very small house next door. The Episcopal Palace itself has been renovated so that it can be a work area for the tasks of the congregation. And the big ornate bishop's throne was gotten rid of so that the local people would feel comfortable at home in the place of their church. Interesting, I think. He has two paintings on his wall. One of them is of an Andean shepherd boy playing a flute amidst the mountains. He says, "The shepherd boy has nothing but his flute, his song, and the gifts of mountain and air. I like to think of myself as a shepherd for my people. I too have a song of love for each one." The other painting that hangs in his room is that of a crucified laborer with work clothes and a brimmed hat, the crucifixion being in the middle of a sugarcane field, and in the background are the smokestacks of factories with smoke going into the air. Of this he says, "A Dutch artist painted this for me, and it is so true. Many Northeasterners are crucified day after day by overwork, hunger, fatigue. You see the profits of the cane rising to the sky, but only the landowner gets richer." One thing that has always attracted me to Domhelder is Well, he's a sparkling little man. He's 5'3", has a little twinkle in his eye, and he, despite the words of the one priest at seminary, he has a very active imagination and uses it often. One of his meditations says, "When on judgment day the angels call the artists in, they will be so proud of their share in God the Father's power of creation that the Son will find it hard to judge them strictly, because poets especially remind him of his Father." Or another one, "Is it true, Lord, that even today you love the sight of water, wind, and light? Is it a fact that you are still affected by birds, by flowers, by children? What I am sure of is that you love just as much to see what keeps emerging from the hands of men with whom you have shared your creative power." Domhelder definitely embodies for me this idea of the artist. He, at one point, talks about a special place in the Abrahamic minorities for the artists. He says the artist shares more directly in the creating power of the Father. Everything in him is unexpected and original. He bridles against regulation, monotony, and routine. One incident from Domhelder's life where I think he shows those qualities in his own being: he flew into some airport and was being greeted, in a big long line of dignitaries, everybody shaking his hands, and he was halfway through this line when all of a sudden a flock of birds went overhead, so he stepped back out of the line and just waved to the birds as they went by, and then went back right back into shaking hands with everybody. That sort of delight is rare and extremely attractive. I would like to read three brief pages out of the beginning of A Thousand Reasons for Living. There are three or four of these short little stories, and the title of this is "Children Will Get the Point." In the full bus, packed to overflowing actually, everyone's attention was drawn to a small boy holding a scrap of wood with extreme care. One lady couldn't bear it any longer and asked him why he was being so careful about this worthless scrap of wood. He explained, "I am taking a little aunt for a ride. She's my great friend. It's her first trip in a bus." Who would ever have thought the kid could have so much poetry and kindness in him? I couldn't keep my eyes off him. When he got off the bus, I got off too. I felt that here was someone I could really talk to. I explained that I too was very fond of little ants. And I told him about the only time when the ants and I had ever been at cross purposes. One night, our little ants at home gobbled up our rose bush. Next morning, I caught Sonia, a little red lady ant and one of the cleverest I ever met in my life. I didn't squeeze her angrily, for God preserved me from anger, but I did hold her with a certain firmness. Her little foot was trembling and her heart was beating fit to burst. I asked her why they had gobbled up my rose bush in a single night. Miss Sonia replied, "Do you think you're the only person to like roses?" At first I was taken aback, but then retorted, "Eating seems such a funny way of loving." At which Sonia nearly made me die of shame by asking, "Isn't that what you do at Holy Communion?" I apologized to her and set her free, carefully putting her back on the ground. For the next 3 days, all the ants looked at me askance. Unable to bear this any longer, I called Sonia and asked her to help me. And this is how, by means of Sonia, I taught the ants to smell the roses instead of eating them. I explained to them that kissing roses goes on all over the place, but not up here in the Northeast. We just smell them. I invited the little boy who was taking his aunt friend for a bus ride to come and visit our garden one moonlit night and see all the ants climbing up the rose bush and smelling the roses. The child didn't react like a grown-up. He wasn't surprised. He didn't disbelieve me. He thought it was great. So I then told him how one day I met a young aunt called Claudia who was limping. We were in the garden at home. With her permission, I turned her over on her back to see what was the matter with her tiny foot. So it was that Claudia for the first time saw the sky. For ants are just like us. Go, 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 run, 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 never pausing to look up and gaze at the sky. On seeing the sky for the first time, Claudia lay open-mouthed with amazement and delight. I soon realized there was no point in asking her about her foot. She wasn't listening. She was looking at the sky. I told the little boy as he got into another bus carrying his aunt on the bit of wood, "If you come to my house one moonlit night, you may very well find the little ants lying on their backs with their heads in the grass, gazing at the moon. Grown-ups, important people, forgive me if I have disappointed or shocked you by forgetting about you for a moment and talking to the children. Didn't Christ say that you can't go to heaven unless you become like little children?" Dumhelder has said, "For me, transition from the natural to the supernatural, from reality to dream, is almost imperceptible." That takes on special significance in terms of the rosebush that he just wrote this story about. To make that connection, he has often been warned about the dangers of living alone. He does have a lot of enemies, those that would like to see him not around, and he lives all by himself, no gates. His response to these people has been, "I also have," he has a guardian angel named Jose. "He also has a little rose bush in the garden out there, and like the rose of the little prince, it says to me, 'I have four thorns to protect you. I see all who come in, and I will defend you.'" That seems to us to be dream rather than reality. In fact, though, once an assassin did come to Dumhelder to kill him. Dumhelder was alone in his house at night, and he heard somebody outside rustling around in the bushes. So he went to the front door and says, "Excuse me, would you like to come in?" So the person came in. He said, "Who are you looking for?" And the man said, "I'm looking for Dumhelder." And he says, "I'm Dumhelder." Well, that openness and frankness completely disarmed the assassin, who confessed what he was going to do and walked out. It makes me wonder if that connection between reality and dream is stronger than sometimes we let it be. I mean, this is a far cry from American handgun protection, and yet for him it has proved to be very effective. The last theme or area of thought is that I would like to leave you with in his writings is just that of complete faith and trust, and I think that's where the source of his hope comes from. I think that's where the source of our hope should come from. I won't say a whole lot about this. I'll just read. I have three meditations here. "Put your ear to the ground and identify the noises around you. Predominant are anxious, restless footsteps, frightened footsteps in the dark, footsteps bitter and rebellious. No sound as yet of hope's first footsteps. Glue your ear to the ground again. Hold your breath. Put out your advance antenna. The master is on his way. Most likely he will not get here when things are going well, but in bad times, when the going's unsure and painful. Don't cry for rhythms that seem to get lost. The rhythms of the winds, of the waters, of the swaying of the trees, of the singing of the birds, of the motions of the stars, of the footsteps of mankind. There is always a musician, or a poet, or some saint, or someone deaf, whom God makes responsible for catching the wandering rhythms before they get lost. What a curious charm autumn has for me. Why do I feel so happy as the leaves turn golden or red, when I know they will soon be falling, leaving the tree stripped and bare? My joy lies in the certainty that life will prevail over death. New buds will burst, new leaves, new fruit. He says, I am well aware that one can say the Abrahamic minorities are like a little ant trying to break a steel plate. Yet they are the source of hope for a world that is more just. A close friend of his summed up this sense of joyous abandon, of just giving himself over in trust and hope to God, in the following. I feel he is getting more and more detached from earthly things, at the same time that he gets more and more immersed in earthly things. Nothing can stop him because he has given up his life for God. That's all I have prepared. Is the film going to be shown tomorrow? Or is it up in the air? Or
will depend some on the day.
Okay, if the weather's not real nice tomorrow, I think sometime in the afternoon a film, Excuse Me, America, will be shown, which just is a delightful look at the man. I highly recommend it to you if you get a chance to tomorrow or at some future date to see that. Other than that, I'll just open it up. If anybody has any questions or comments, I'll do whatever I can to... I think it was as early as 1963, even before he was transferred to Recife Olinda, that he, at the Vatican Council, was urging the church to once again take on poverty. An interesting story that I ran across about his sense of poverty, that it, and this refers more to poverty of spirit rather than material goods. Fulton Sheen, who is Bishop of
somewhere in New York.
Is it New York?
Rochester.
Dumhelder and Bishop Sheen were talking at one point, and Dumhelder, in private, the two of them were talking, Dumhelder asked, why is it that you never speak out against racism? And Bishop Sheen at the time said, well, because I have chosen not to, even though I am very much against it. I have chosen not to because I have considered it more, my work to be more effective if I raise money for certain emergency funds. I guess Bishop Sheen was raising lots of funds at the time. And he knew that if he spoke out against racism, that he would not get these funds in to help people. And that was the choice he had made. And Dumhelder used that example to explain what a true poverty was, because Bishop Sheen was putting himself in the position of he didn't care that people thought he should be speaking out against racism. He didn't care that people disagreed with him because he felt he was more effective in doing what he was doing rather than in presenting a certain image. I just found that interesting little.
Does he find the Pope supporting?
I didn't read anything recent enough to say what he thinks about John Paul. He's had nothing but good relationships both with John the 23rd and with Pope Paul. He has been supported by the popes, and he is such a loyal churchman, though, that he has said that at any point if a pope would tell him to stop doing a certain thing, he would stop doing it, even if he felt it was wrong to stop. I could have mentioned earlier when he was in seminary and that the poetry was taken away from him. He was told to get rid of certain books of poetry and so forth, and he did. You know, for the time that he was at seminary, he went back to it. But he hasn't had any conflicts with popes thus far.
he wouldn't feel that quite, you know, being that obedient was compromising.
Apparently not. He's a strange mix that way.
Dorothy Day said the same thing. The Pope had told her not to have the Catholic worker, she would have stopped. That's amazing. It was that same kind of loyal to the church.
Well, there's a real lack of egoism in that. Mm-hmm. A real giving yourself up. If you get a chance to see the film, one of the beginning quotes, and I ran into it in about four different books that I read, was when Dumhelder was considering becoming a priest, his father says to him, if you become a priest, you know there is no room for egoism. You have to completely give yourself over to the service of others or something to that effect. And, you know, he's borne that out. If he disagrees with somebody, he doesn't write them off and become convinced that his way is right. Let's see. He says at one point, in no respect do I pretend to have the key solution. I am seeking it. I am not an expert, either in economics or sociology or politics. I am a pastor and I see my people suffering. And so I reflect. I try to find a way. I ask for the collaboration of those who can think. And he seems to gather that information from all sources. He's traveled in the United States. I don't think he's spent any great blocks of time. Somewhere I ran into... He's asked all the time to speak all over the world, and I can't recall what the percentage is, but he just, you know, picked a percentage of his time that is going to be spent in Brazil. He's not going to let himself become big on the lecture circuit. And so out of the invitations that come in every year, he just picks certain ones. And he has been to the U.S. That's in the film a couple times when that's where the title comes from, Excuse Me, America, as he's looking out at the slums of an American city. Excuse Me, America, in special English. Anything else? If you're interested in any of his books, I would recommend, I like them both, if you want one over the other, I would recommend The Desert is Fertile, because it includes just some of his thoughts as well as the meditations. It gives a nice, it gives a more rounded picture of him, I think. Although there's a couple gems in here that you really shouldn't miss either. But if you look for it in the bookstore, this edition went out of print and it has a different cover now. It's a little bigger and more expensive and so forth. So you'll look for a different cover.